Hi, I'm your host, Frank Peters. Welcome back to the show. Today's show is being featured on breatheoregon.org. It's a website that features news and interviews about air pollution, industrial pollution in Portland and the state of Oregon. Check them out, please. Well, today my guest is a young entrepreneur. He's got a startup company that attempts to share environmental data with neighborhood activists. More than just data, tools and strategies on how to influence elected officials and others to mitigate the situation. Let's listen.
My name is Nick Bedbury. I am the co-founder and CEO at Upstream Research.
Very nice. Thanks for joining me so early this morning, Nick. I appreciate it.
No problem.
Nick, Mary Pivato introduced the two of us. Tell me, how do you know Mary Pivato?
I know Mary Pivato actually as a family friend. My father's known her for a very long time. And we reconnected about 8 months ago once we were starting the air quality aspect of Upstream Research. And we were very much impressed and inspired by a lot of the work that she was doing.
I can imagine. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's quite a coincidence.
Yeah,
isn't it?
That's great.
Yeah, very good. And Nick, what is Upstream Research?
Upstream Research is a spatial health company. So we gather as much information as we can from the government and other sources about potential environmental exposure and disease health risks or health patterns in a given area. Currently, we're in the United States, but we've built our system eventually to be global.
Mm-hmm. You're one of the founders of the company. How did you get this started? Did you go out for funding or did you fund it yourself?
We did actually go out for funding. So We raised a round of seed capital last year. That round closed about May. Mm-hmm. And that's funded the development of a couple things for us. Mm-hmm. First, it's helped us build a very large database that has lots of state and federal information inside of it. And second, it's allowed us to build both our reporting platform we've made available to the public, as well as a larger analytics platform for decision makers, be it government or other organizations.
And what was that funding process like? Did you get a lot of interest quickly, or did it take you a while to tell your story to the right people?
You know, it's a big, hairy idea. So a lot of what we had to do was bring focus to the issue and lay out the steps of where we were going. We found a lot of positive responses. I think that we spoke with a lot of great mission-minded folks who ended up investing, who believe in improving environmental quality and improving the overall health of communities and neighborhoods. But for us, the goal was to get the story to a point that people felt comfortable that we could actually execute on it. You can have a lot of great ideas and you can have a lot of great ambitions, but making sure that people feel like this is a plan that you can execute against is critical.
Mm-hmm.
And we got there with those investors, and they believe in us. But a lot of it was getting our story concise and getting the steps in place that it feels like we can go to market effectively and that we can carry out what we say we're going to do.
Mm-hmm. Are you first-time entrepreneurs at raising money?
This is my first time as a CEO and co-founder raising money. I've been a part of a number of other companies that have gone through this process. So it wasn't my first rodeo, but it was definitely my first time in the pilot seat.
Mm-hmm. Well, congratulations to you and good luck.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, Frank.
So you posted on Facebook some time ago, probably about a month ago, and I spotted it right away, probably through, because I follow Mary Pivato.
Mm-hmm.
What were some of those early posts that I might have seen on Facebook, Nick?
Well, a lot of what we're focusing on today and in the coming months here in early 2017 is around air quality and air quality metrics, and then also lead exposure for children.
Mm.
So we have two really compelling groups of data sets around some of the air quality metrics that are out there. And again, these can be improved, but what's been made available. And then also around lead exposure and that risk for children and actually rates of BLL, blood lead level, in children. So a lot of our initial posts and initial press has been around either dealing with air toxics or speaking to lead exposure risk for children.
Wow. Lead exposure risk for children. That's mm-hmm. been in the news in the Portland area, the public school system.
Mm-hmm.
Testing water fountains.
Yes.
Water in the schools. They found a lot of lead in the water. So that's something that really excited moms and dads all over Multnomah County.
Absolutely.
And it seems to be a, I don't know, would you say it's a persistent problem in Portland?
I think it can be said that it's a persistent problem in Portland. But I think that it's a larger national issue as well. A lot of the data that we have today suggests to us that there are about 3,000 neighborhoods, census tracts in the United States that have a higher lead exposure risk than the three in Flint, Michigan. And actually, the observed blood lead levels in children in those 3,000 census tracts approximately, many of them, of the rate of the tested kids is actually higher than that in Flint. So there's a hidden crisis. So it affects Portland, but it also affects many of the cities you would think of in the industrial Northeast and actually through the Mountain West. So it's a problem that is definitely not being addressed properly.
And of course, the overwhelming concern parents have about lead in drinking water is what exactly, Nick?
So lead plays a couple different roles in childhood development, negative roles, obviously. Mostly it's around cognitive development, so it can actually impair, there's studies around impairing IQ. It can also lead to other learning disabilities. And in extreme cases, it can actually lead to more harmful health outcomes, poisoning, which is a different situation. But low-level lead, persistent low-level lead, the primary concern is around cognitive development.
Right. And it's permanent damage, I understand. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's lasting damage.
Right. So by tracking these cities and the statistics that you do,
our goal is to actually make this information as usable and as available as possible.
Right.
So in January, we're going to make, we already make, if you sign up, the first few reports you create free. But we're working to take our, and specifically our lead exposure risk data set, and make it a publicly available resource to anyone, even if you don't sign up. So mm-hmm. build a map, allow anyone to look at any place in the United States and assess its lead risk.
Right.
What we've actually done in December was we took all 98,000 schools, and there's a little bit more, but this is what's listed with the Department of Education, all 98,000 public and private schools, specifically the preschools and elementary schools, and we actually rated their lead risk, their lead exposure risk, and have actually highlighted about 5,000 schools of concern that if they haven't already been tested, should be tested. Mm-hmm. And then we've worked at a metro level, a city level mapping project to then try and raise awareness in each city about schools that sit in neighborhoods with elevated risks and trying to draw attention to the fact that if the children in these schools haven't been tested, they should be tested. If the water hasn't been tested, it should be tested. And if the paint or certain key physical environmental factors haven't been tested, they should be tested. Because our forecast and some of the observed rates would suggest that there is a driver of lead exposure risk in that area.
Mm-hmm. Now, parents, once they find out about this lead exposure risks, they're pretty quick to get excited. Is that mm-hmm. what you see as well?
Absolutely. And part of what we did this summer was a bit of research around customer and user insights groups. So we spoke to these issues with a group of moms in Seattle and in Philadelphia, as well as real estate buyers and community involved civic activists. And kind of went through the steps of, okay, well, what would you like to have in front of you? How does this make you feel? You know, what do you want to do with this? And they're especially parents are very quick to say, all right, what are the action steps we need to take? What can I do to protect my child? And then what can I do to mm-hmm. partner in the community to try and remove this threat?
Right. Now, Flint, Michigan has spilled a lot of ink, they say. Mm-hmm. But where can we look to see adequate government response to mitigating lead? Are there examples out there of people doing the right thing?
There are. I think that Washington State and its Department of Ecology actually has a pretty good program around trying to remediate lead risk. They actually developed some of the underlying science that we use in one of our lead risk exposure scores. So And that was only about 2 years ago that they kind of developed this system for trying to forecast lead risk. And they've now used it in a pretty aggressive program around water testing and then paint, repainting, paint remediation, figuring out how to get into neighborhoods that are chronically underserved and historically impoverished, and basically making available free paint and free painting resources and test kits to address some of this risk. So the state of Washington's been actually doing a lot of good work in a number of rural areas. But honestly, this is an issue that until Flint came around was completely off the radar. Many people thought that this issue had just been resolved with the the unleading of gas and a couple things that were more egregious 20 or 30 years ago. Lead had kind of slipped from the radar. So there aren't really as many cases today. There's a lot of good efforts going on in different major cities. Chicago is also trying to test the lead and surfaces in their public schools, but they also still face a very large risk in Chicago. So their response is in line with the scale of the challenge they're facing. But in terms of results, we won't really know the results until more testing is done and we can see the rate of children with elevated levels of lead in their blood decrease.
Wow. It's terrible to think of permanent brain damage, cognitive damage to children. Is this a worldwide problem or just in the United States?
It is a worldwide problem, but even in the United States, you can see that different factors create different risk profiles. So certain parts of the world, lead is not going to be the risk. Lead risk exposure really sits with a particular type of housing and environmental, like structural environmental concern. So there are other industrial and post-industrial economies where lead risk is elevated, but yeah, it's not universal, but it definitely is present on every continent, and there's numerous countries. I think the WHO did a report around air quality risk and around heavy metal exposure risk, and they put the number of children at elevated risk for heavy metal exposure in the 50 to 100 million range conservatively and 300 million on the high end. So there's it's a very large percentage of children in the world that are at risk for this, and it is a problem that is of global concern. Mm-hmm. However, there are other nastier heavy metals and persistent, volatile compounds that present risks in different places around the world.
Well, maybe that's our transition here, Nick, is to talk about some of those topics. Is the key to building a movement to mitigate these risks is the kind of reporting that your company is going to do, letting everybody in the neighborhood know what the problems are so they can mobilize and act?
Exactly. Yeah. It's we're trying to make it as simple as possible. So in the coming months, improvements to our product will allow someone to basically, from their phone or from their tablet or laptop, put in their address and see a simplified kind of composite rating of what's going on around them in their neighborhood and flag something that may be of concern and then offer them a series of action steps. Mm-hmm. It can be, in the case of lead, and that's why we're focusing on lead, because there's a lot of very simple, cheap, easy ways for people to get involved with it. Pretty much any child in the United States can have their blood tested for free if their parents are concerned and they go to their pediatrician. There's a number of large programs around SCHIP and Medicaid to try and make sure that any kid can be tested. And then the other steps are actually pretty simple. There's little $5 and $15 kits to either swab a surface, be it your paint in your house, or test your water and see if there is any sort of heavy metal contaminant present. So these are simple steps that someone can take, simple action steps, and we make it easily available to someone. So our goal with this is, yes, to take an environmental exposure risk of concern, like lead, and make it very simple and easy for someone to see it and how it impacts them locally or doesn't. Lead's not present everywhere. In lots of places in the West, you don't have an elevated concern for lead exposure. But if you do live in one of those neighborhoods, it's good to know, and there are simple steps you can take.
So, Nick, I'm looking online, and I can see your upstream report on a cell phone screen. So one thing to clarify is you're not actually doing the monitoring or measuring yourself. You're aggregating the data from multiple sources?
That is correct, yes. So currently, as it stands, we've downloaded and basically ingested government data largely. So there are some nonprofit organizations that also create some data that we bring in, but currently we're showcasing it on our platform. A lot of the formats in which this data arrived was very difficult for an individual to use. So we've converted it to a common database format, and then we visualize it and deliver it easily. Mm-hmm. There are some things that we do around forecasting risk and around forecasting disease patterns that is some of our intellectual property that we help kind of improve, fill in the picture and some of the edges. But 99% of what you're looking at is data that's been collected and verified, and we can trace it to a source, typically within the government.
Mm-hmm. So within your company, Nick, you've got a bunch of programmers, I can imagine, mm-hmm. database people, and public health people too?
Yeah. So we have a great group of advisors, people that are really passionate about what we're doing, and they run the spectrum of public health to toxicologists and epidemiologists that are passionate about bringing the environmental factor into public health specifically, that we look at genetics, we look at behavior, but currently in healthcare and in public health, environmental factors are not receiving the same attention, mm-hmm. Even though as a determinant of health, it sits on par with genetics. And in most studies, it exceeds even the quality of care people receive as an outcome. So there's most of our advisors are in this background of environmental toxicology. I've got an epidemiologist and a toxicologist, and they're passionate about us trying to make the case for environmental measurement and environmental exposure measurement inside of healthcare and public health.
Mm-hmm. Nick, I was doing my homework. I'm a long-term air quality advocate myself. And before I moved to Portland, I was watching, observing their, you know, air quality index for probably more than a year.
Mm-hmm.
And that measures what? PM 2.5 and what else?
Yeah, AQI would measure, usually it's particulate matter, and mm-hmm. then there are some other secondary measures around environmental ozone.
Ozone, right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and then you can typically have on an AQI, they'll sometimes work in PM 10, so not quite as fine particulate matter.
Right, so I thought I was doing everything I needed to do to make sure I was moving to, mm-hmm. a cleaner, healthier environment. But as we both know, what I wasn't able to observe and track was the industrial pollution mm-hmm. that exploded on the scene, the Oregon DEQ.
Last year. Mm-hmm.
Right, last February, an emergency press conference in February mm-hmm. to announce what many of us would simply label the bullseye glass scandal.
Yep.
The problem there is nobody was tracking that data.
Exactly.
So you wouldn't have been able to offer that information because you didn't have it either.
So it's a great point. So in our first phase, our aim was to take everything that's already been created by the government mm-hmm. and make it available. In our second phase, we're working on filling in the holes and forecasting risk and then empowering individuals to help report and measure areas of concern. So what we're building now is another data set around the businesses that are present in communities and if those businesses conform to a risk profile. So specifically because we looked at the bullseye glass incident and said, all right, if it's not in the toxic release inventory, the TRI, which they're supposed to, that was a violation, that they weren't reporting what was being emitted, the heavy metals, the cadmium, and the fact that they were in non-compliance with their baghouse, it's a different thing entirely. But mm-hmm. what we're working on now is moving towards forecasting. So we're looking at the nature of each industry and saying, okay, is this in the TRI? Has it been reported? And is it being worked into some of the modeling? Or is this business and it's the industrial classification it sits in an at-risk classification? And if it's not in the TRI, we should flag it. So what we're working through is we're now bringing in private source data that you can purchase from any sort of commercial aggregator and saying these are all the business listings in the United States of America and these are what these industries are doing. And then we're trying to work that back against is it present already or is it unaccounted for? And so we're starting to flag unaccounted for sources. It's not currently in the reports product, but that's mm-hmm. our goal mm-hmm. by the end of this quarter is to have forecasting data sets. So we would flag something as saying that it's not measured, but it is considered an at-risk site based on other factors.
So let me see if I can echo that back, Nick. So part of the challenge you face there is some of these industries aren't in the TRI, the index that mm-hmm. they should be. Some of them are under the radar altogether. So that's bigger than a bread box, the challenge that you face, isn't it? Yeah.
It is, but we see it for us as it builds value for our database and our company to be aggregating that.
Yes, very clearly. So, I can see that. Yeah.
So we're passionate about it, and it's not a small challenge. But what we see is after the first stage, so A, there's a number of things that are already in the data that's present that are going unaddressed. So a lot of the stuff is we have lower hanging fruit in terms of data that we can verify that was gathered by the government that's just not getting the attention that it needs. But absolutely, in the case of Bullseye and in Portland, our next step is to empower individuals to help us measure and report areas of concern, and then to build a forecasting mechanism looking at what has existed.
You took the question right out of my head
Nick.
Right, is, you can empower people that will be following your site and using your data to, they've got a vested interest in identifying the industries in their own neighborhood.
Absolutely. And that's for us, that's where we, that's pretty much the only way we can deal with a challenge as big as Bullseye Glass or the next Bullseye Glass is if we have community advocates and engaged individuals who are interested in defending their neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And that's our personal belief. It's my personal belief and our company's belief is that going forward, making the environment personal and making it local will help galvanize the next generation of environmental protection and activism.
Mm-hmm. What I observed in the Portland area was that our local elected officials responded very positively to the Bullseye Glass scandal. I think that, of course, many of them genuinely motivated to do the right thing, but at the same time, I think it was clear to many elected officials that this was a new constituency that might be forming and that their contributions in terms of leadership might generate quite a bit of recognition.
Absolutely. And a lot of the conversations we've had in the last 90 days have been with mayors and local civic officials, mostly in the Northwest, about what reports means and could mean for their community and how they can actually take a leadership role in this. So we see it as a very large opportunity. And yes, you're correct. You know, it's hard to tell sometimes with a politician what they're motivated by, but they're definitely responding to engaged individuals and engaged citizens.
Right, right. Let's tie this all together, Nick, back to Mary Pivito and Neighbors for Clean Air.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have some projects that you're actually going to be working together on?
Yeah, so we were just speaking yesterday about it. I can't reveal the projects yet, but we've got
couple
you could good
tell
ideas.
You could tease us with a little.
You know, what we're trying to do is, so Mary is almost one of the people that we see 100 Marys popping up potentially in the next couple of years in different communities as we make this information more available. So Mary is kind of this leader, vanguard, pilot of however we can help. So we're kind of almost designing our program for how we want to help local leaders around Mary and learning a lot about what would help Mary. So first things first for us is we're going to try and use as much of the information that Neighbors for Clean Air has gathered already, which is its own set of information, and integrate it into our reporting platform and help amplify it and make it even more available than it has been. The second one is we're going to help integrate a lot with some of the social networks and groups out there and begin to galvanize greater change. So bring more folks, A, to her and to the issue. And then in the long run, we've talked a lot about trying to integrate new sensor networks to kind of keep other sensor networks honest. So that's about as much as I can tease around it. But you can look to think to see Mary and her group as being on the leading edge of probably this next wave if we succeed in local activism, local concern, and local empowerment. Be it through sensors or testing.
And perhaps your opinion, Nick, on why is Mary so effective? Why is she at the forefront in Portland?
She, and this is, I might be personally biased because I know her through other capacities. It's a mix of her personality and how she operates her organization. I think that she is very direct and very passionate. and genuinely cares about the issues, but is very much open to collaboration and bringing in different parties and people. Mm-hmm. So she's exactly who you'd want help to, you know, to lead any movement like this. So I think that she was already in the conversation around clean air in Portland before the Bullseye Glass incident, and she'll be there through whatever else happens because she's such a consistent figure and great leader of that group. But I think it also comes back to just being a parent who's concerned about her neighborhood. Mm-hmm. We had a number of conversations about the neighborhood she lives in northwest Portland, mm-hmm. and some of her other concerns around industrial air pollutants and then black carbon and all that. So she's passionate, she's knowledgeable, and she's just a really, really great person. So I it doesn't shock me that she's successful. There's right. a number of things that make her successful.
Right. She's got a lot of experience. She's been at it a long time. Mm-hmm. Nick, one of the things I told my new friends in Portland about as people started to come together and form these social networks and advocacy groups was that, in my opinion, this wasn't going to be solved in 6 months or a year or 2 years. I would tell people this is going to take you the rest of your life. Am I too pessimistic on that?
You know, it doesn't necessarily need to be pessimistic that it'll take the rest of your life. I think that it's a bit like exercise or eating healthy or anything like that. Yeah, technically that's something that'll take you the rest of your life, but it doesn't mean that it's going to be without progress, and it doesn't mean that it actually can't be have its own little victories and joys. So I don't necessarily see this ending anytime soon, especially because of our political climate. But I do see us making really interesting and rapid strides. And that's why we're a startup as opposed to another nonprofit, is we want to use disruptive technology specifically in this instance to possibly create a large shift in the same way that Uber or Airbnb has changed the way someone has dealt with hospitality or transportation. We do believe that the proliferation of sensors, the digitization of all of these databases, and the large interconnected nature of social networks enables us as a small group of people to potentially galvanize change in a big way. Doesn't mean that the issue would go away, but we may see engagement and the pace of change occur differently 2 or 3 years from now. So I'm hopeful in that. I think that this is the beginning of us turning over a new leaf with new engagement and people taking more of an active role in managing their environment and protecting their families. But yes, you're correct. Some of these issues will never go away. And it's the nature of some of these things that they'll never go away. But we can manage them and we can make progress every day.
Very well said, Nick. Back to your status as a startup company, Nick. When you raise money from investors and venture capitalists, you've got to paint the picture of the exit. Mm-hmm. What's the exit for you? Who would buy Upstream Research someday?
Well, we see a couple of different things in a potential mm-hmm. exit. So part of our goal is to make the environment something that's relevant to health and relevant to even real estate. So we see that as kind of our secret sauce in terms of getting people to be more engaged beyond your expected folks who would care about the environment. And I'm one of those folks that would be the expected folks. But we see by tying the environment to local impacts on health and eventually local impacts on the livability or the overall value of a given real estate community, we see that those two things can drive interest in other industries that normally don't pay any attention to the environment. So you could see an exit strategy where what we've developed is something akin to Carfax or WalkScore for environmental health. Mm-hmm. And it's something that then wants to be integrated into a system of either healthcare or real estate, sure. Be it listings or whatnot. So we definitely have had already good conversations and strong interest expressed by large companies in those spaces looking to either acquire a license or acquire us or our technology in order to help kind of lead that next generation of how people think about buying real estate or pursuing medicine or pursuing medical research. Mm-hmm. So in the long run, that's something that we see happening. Mm-hmm. In the near term, there's still strong interest as well, and we're in conversations with sensor manufacturers, people who see that increased engagement around this issue will inevitably lead to increased consumption, effectively, of sensors and tests and all these new gadgets that people are going to want to use to be measuring their environment.
You're going
to
drive consumption of these monitoring devices. I get it.
Grow the community. Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm.
And I just bought some real estate myself, Nick, just before Thanksgiving. And so that meant that I spent months and months and months on real estate websites. And they have other kinds of statistics, like you can see a relative occurrence of crime in any particular neighborhood. And that's just another piece of data in a statistic in a database somewhere. So in some ways, I could see your environmental statistics showing up there too.
We do see that, and that's something that we've been kind of piloting and testing. And we're not looking to red line or green line any location. I think what people will be surprised to find is that there are many neighborhoods that seem very nice that do have certain risks that are not present. And there are many neighborhoods that people have written off that actually environmentally are relatively clean. So we think it's something that, yeah, it fits in that profile of a walk score or a school grade or a crime score, is something around the health of this community and the environmental exposure risk of this community.
Well, Nick, it's been nice to chat with you this morning, and I'm excited about the prospects for upstream research. I wish you the best of luck.
Absolutely. Thank you, Frank.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, we're back in the studio, and before I say goodbye, once again, I'm your host, Frank Peters, and this episode today being featured on BreatheOregon.org. Check them out, please. Well, until next time, thanks so much for listening, and good day.